watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is on Welcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Hermann Göring, defense minister of Nazi Germany and Adolf Hitler's designated successor, once offered this observation. "Why, of course the people don't want war," Göring said. "Why should some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war when the best he can get out of it is to come back to his farm in one piece?" Naturally, the common people don't want war, neither in Russia, nor in England, nor, for that matter, in Germany. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it is always a simple matter to drag the people along. Whether it is a democracy, or a fascist dictatorship, or a parliament, or a communist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked, and denounce the peacemakers for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country. Close quote. If the people do not want war, why is it that the leaders do? War is and always has been big business. Tonight we'll focus on the relationship between war and profit, from the Roman Empire to Bush's new war.
We trot in this dark here, robbing the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black.
Within days of the September 11th attacks, a mentality many describe as totalitarian had gripped the country, accompanied by a new Office of Homeland Security and legislation designed to increase the government's ability to monitor activities, all in the name of a war on terrorism. History has much to teach us about the actions and motivations of government, and how people are convinced to support policies which do not benefit them at all, says historian Howard Zinn. He spoke at an anti-war teach-in in Boston on September 25th.
Well, it was a great turnout. Yeah, don't you think so? Really? It's really heartwarming to see these people who can't get seats that's standing up through all of this. Well, Anthony started to talk about history, and I'll just continue where he left off, because I will just follow him, whatever he says. He's my editor, and, you know, I feel very subservient. You know, they, you know who they is? There's a they and a we, right? There's they and there's we. That's the world. And they want us to forget history. They want us to act as if we were born yesterday. Because if you forget history, if you were born yesterday, then you will believe anything. Anytime the president or any official gets up before the microphone and tells you, well, this is what happened and this is what we must do. Well, if you have no history, if you have no memory, well, how can you check up? How can you know? You know, especially when from the time you were in grade school, you were ordered to stand up and pledge allegiance to the flag, right? You were disciplined right from the start and told to obey the rules and listen to the people in authority. Notice the enormous move to obey the president. Did you see in the newspapers that, you know, our news commentators are objective people, right? You go to journalism school and they talk very seriously about objectivity, you know, report and so on and so forth. And then there are these anchor people. You know, what are they anchored to, you say? They're anchored to the establishment. That's why they're called anchor people, you see. And one of these anchor people, Dan Rather, was quoted, some of you may have seen this, was quoted as saying sometime last week, I saw this in the International Herald Tribune. This is one of those one-upmanship things, you know. Who reads the International Herald Tribune? I do. You see. I saw this in the International Herald Tribune. And Dan Rather was quoted on national television as saying, he's the president. When the president says, get in line, I get in line. Now, this, you know what I immediately thought of? Totalitarianism. Really, I thought that's what we used to say. You know, our leader has spoken. You know, get in line. You know, don't ask questions. You know, and our leaders are wise. That's, well, but what's encouraging is that there are people in this room and people in rallies and gatherings all over this country who are not getting in line. And that's very comforting for us. And they want us to forget the history of governments and the history of our government. I.F. Stone, some of you may have heard of, you know, one of the great journalists of the 20th century. I.F. Stone would be invited to speak to journalism classes, and he would say to these people who were going to be journalists, he said, look, if you really want to be a good journalist, you just have to remember two words. Governments lie. You see, and that is a fact. I mean, not just our government, but governments lie. Does this sound like an anarchist statement? You see, and anarchism is a philosophy. Anarchism isn't a bunch of hoodlums going around. That's not anarchism. That's the government. You see. See, but. But the anarchist philosophers, and I'm not talking about those few anarchists who decided to imitate the government and throw a bomb here or there, assassinate. No, the anarchists in general, anarchists as a philosophical group of as organizers, you know, Emma Goldman and Peter Kropotkin and Alexander Berkman, and, you know, they understood the nature of governments. And the nature of governments is to lie. Well, for a very simple reason. Because if governments told the truth, they wouldn't be in power very long, you see. And so it's very, very important to know the history of governments. Very important to know the history of American governments, right? And to think of how, especially in wartime, I mean, there's something about wartime that brings out prevarication. Lies. But, you know, I've never used the word prevarication publicly. I thought I would try it out tonight. You see. There's something about war that brings it out, you know. And so, you know, the Mexican War. I know all of you remember the Mexican War. I mean, how do you think we got Texas and Colorado and Arizona and New Mexico and California? Because the Mexicans liked us and gave it to us. They're kind people. They have that Latin generosity, you see. But it was in the Mexican War that we acquired that territory, roughly half of Mexico, and we thought the Mexicans should be grateful we didn't take all of Mexico, you see. But the Mexican War started with a lie, you know. Oh, wow. There's always an incident and a lie. And so there was this incident on the border, you know, the Texas-Mexican border between the Nueces River and the Rio Grande River, and a clash, and American troops go into this disputed territory. There's a clash, people are killed, and the president, I started to say, goes before the microphone, but I guess, no, they didn't have that. President Polk announces to the country that American blood has been shed on American soil. I mean, later, many, many years later, when I heard President Bush, the elder, say, you know, they've insulted an American soldier in Panama. What are we going to do about it? Oh, no, actually, an American soldier's wife, because I forgot, he's a feminist. And this must not be allowed, you see. But, you know, they've... American blood has been shed on American soil, and soon, you know, the armies are there on their way to Mexico City. No. And soon we have, as I say, half of Mexico. Lies. 1898, the battleship Maine is sunk in Havana Harbor. By the way, nobody asks, when they discuss, and they always, this always come, there's one thing you learn about American history. You learn about the battleship Maine. There's about seven things you learn about in American history. And one is the sinking of the Maine and how that led to the Spanish-American War. And in none of the textbooks that deal with it, and none of the classes that deal with it, certainly none of the classes that I ever attended that dealt with American history, does anybody ask the question, what was the battleship Maine doing in Havana Harbor? You know, it's like when the American destroyer was attacked, right? In Yemen, right? I didn't see any newscasters ask, what was an American destroyer doing way, way out there? You know, it's like the Gulf of, you know, and, you know, when the Gulf of Tonkin incident took place in 1964, you know, oh, wow, they've attacked American destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin. Where is the Gulf of Tonkin? You know, it's, I guess it must be off the coast of San Francisco. Because maybe if you really showed a map and showed where the Gulf of Tonkin is, you might ask, what were American destroyers doing off the coast of Vietnam, so far from home, you see? But lies were told about that. And the lies that were told about that led immediately to Congress passing resolutions giving... Does that sound familiar? Congress passing resolutions giving the president full power to do whatever he wants to do in the Gulf of Tonkin, leading to a 10-year war in Vietnam which cost several million lives. Another lesson from history. Don't trust Congress. Don't believe in checks and balances, that stuff that you got in junior high school. Oh, what a wonderful system we have. One branch will check the other branch, you know, and that way nothing bad can happen, you see. In time of war, Congress is always a flock of sheep, you see. And so is the Supreme Court. You know, the Supreme Court doesn't fool around with war, however unconstitutional the war is. Whatever rights are being taken away by the war, the Supreme Court will not defend those constitutional rights. Well, Anthony mentioned Debs. You know, the Supreme Court voted unanimously that Debs should go to jail for speaking out against the war. Hey, what about the First Amendment? Like, the members of the Supreme Court never read the First Amendment to the Constitution. Doesn't matter. It's time of war. Time of war, we all become yes men, all of them. The Congress, the Supreme Court, and so, you know, there you have, just as happened last week, you know, Congress, at the time of the Gulf of Tonkin, voting almost unanimously in the House, almost unanimously in the Senate, almost two dissenting votes by Senators Wayne Morse and Gruning. If people knew some history and heard about this near unanimous vote, the one heroic vote against it by the African-American congresswoman from California, Barbara Lee. If people knew some history, if the teachers gave them history, if the media gave people a little history, if anybody with power over our communications network gave people some history, they might recognize in this rush of Congress towards war, they might recognize that same subservience that Congress has always shown when it comes to matters of war. So history can be useful. History can come in handy to tell you something about governments, to tell you something about the structure of governments, to tell you something about deceptions and lies. Because if people knew that history, they wouldn't simply sit back and listen to Bush and sort of be impressed by the fact that he knows how to read, you see. The media, too. I mean, you think in a democratic country there'd be... And I remember when I was taking courses in political science, when I foolishly took courses in political science, they would talk about, very soberly, seriously, about pluralism, American pluralism, you know, all the different divergent ideas and so on in the United States. But in times of crisis, there's no pluralism. There's one voice. And so when Bush gives that speech, as he did last week, everybody, all of the media, and all of the television experts rushing before the camera saying, what a beautiful speech. Did you notice his face? Did you notice, you know, the way he timed his words? None of them had anything to say about the substance of his speech, because that's not important, because it doesn't matter what the substance is. We'll do what he says, you see. We must learn something about the history of governments and the history of the relationship of people to governments. And must learn something about what democracy is. Democracy is not falling in line behind the president. Democracy is for people to think independently, to be skeptical of government, to check up for themselves, to look around and try to find out what's going on. And then, if they see that the government is deceiving them, to speak out as loudly as they can. That's democracy. Well, Anthony was giving you some of the history of American foreign policy, particularly with regard to Iraq, but that's a history that needs to be recalled. I'm not going to recall it all for you. It would take a while, because our foreign policy has been very full, you know, We're not Switzerland, you see. We are a great power. A great power has a lot of foreign policy, most of it bad, you see. But that, the history of our foreign policy is very important, because without it, we will not understand how much animosity we have engendered in various parts of the world, not just in the Middle East, but elsewhere. We won't be able to understand that. If we don't have any history, we will live our lives with the kind of things we were taught in elementary school, that the United States is a force for democracy and liberty in the world. And we have been the Boy Scouts of the world, you know, helping countries across the street, you know. And, no. But to study the history of American foreign policy is to study the history of an imperial power, a power that took over from the British Empire and the French and the German and the Russian and the Dutch empires, and that established the most powerful empire of all after World War II, and it sent its troops all over the world and sent its ships all over the seas and intervened again and again in places so far from home, nobody could talk about it as being defensive. And in its foreign policy, consigned several million people to their deaths. And in this foreign policy, supported terrorist governments in various parts of the world, especially in Central America, especially in the Middle East. So the history of American foreign policy is a very important thing to know. And I'm stressing all this because I think that we all need to become communicators of this history. Because since the public is not getting the history in the schools, the public is not getting the history from television or from the newspapers, it then becomes the job of informed citizens to do the kind of education that is lacking in the major media and in the culture. Because, and here's what I found, that as soon as people get a little of this history, it makes sense to them. They recognize it. Now, all this stuff about, 90% of the American people support Bush, sure, you know, because their memories have been wiped out, because they're treated as if they were born yesterday. And I have found in talking to people, and I think this is important to keep in mind, but as soon as you begin telling people a little bit, reminding people a little bit, hey, remember Vietnam? Hey, remember the Gulf War and all the hoopla and the yellow ribbons and so on? And now, you know, all these people in Iraq are dead as a result of our No? Remember, as soon as people learn, think a little, and learn a little history. As soon as you tell them something about the history of terrorism, and you point out to them all the times that terrorist acts have been committed and what has happened when governments have used force to say, we are going to stamp out terrorism, just as in this case. And then there's more terrorism. And then there's more force. And of course, the force isn't called terrorism, but it is. Because any time you use violence indiscriminately and kill innocent people, you are engaging in terrorism. You see. Anyway. And so we have to broaden our definition of terrorism. And we have to think that this awful thing that happened on September 11th, yes, we need to feel deeply about that and feel for the victims of that and feel for the families of that, but we also need to learn from it. And we all need also to, when we remember the scenes, remember the scenes of the people racing in shock from those fires, and the scenes of people crushed under the weight of the buildings, we ought to remember that these are scenes that have taken place in various parts of the world for a long time, and that therefore we need to see terrorism as an international phenomenon. The United States is not the only victim, and American citizens are not the only victims of terrorism. Because if we are going to have one world, if we are really, you know, it's interesting that people talk about globalization and free flow of markets and free markets, but they don't talk about international solidarity of people. They don't say that we should consider people everywhere, everywhere in the world as our brothers and sisters, that we should see the children all over the world as our children, and therefore we mustn't bomb these places. We mustn't invade these places. We mustn't use military force because this is all one human family and we must not do damage to any members, you know, of this family. This is, you know... Just one more thing about remembering and not being born yesterday. Let's remember that the American people, Lincoln was right. You can fool some of the people all the time, all of the people some of the time, but not all of the people all of the time. Remember? And Lincoln, and he's right, because if people do wake up, people do learn, people do come to their senses after that first wave of, oh, support the government, people do look around, and their common sense and their common humanity tells them, and we've seen this in the past, tells them something is wrong here. People woke up to what was happening to black people in the South at a certain point, and then whites joined the movement, and it became a national movement. People learned after a while what was happening, what we were doing to people in Vietnam, and they woke up and we had a great national movement. So never think because of the polls, or never think because of the huzzas for the president that come from the press and the anchors. You know, never think that they are going to have it their way and the people will be fooled all of the time. We've seen movements grow from groups of people like this gathered all over the country to great national movements. We need another one today, and we may be on the way to one. Thank you.
That was Howard Zinn, Professor Emeritus of History at Boston University, speaking on September 25th in Boston. The bombing of Afghanistan has been presented to the American people as retaliation for the September 11th bomb attacks, which the U.S. government has blamed on Osama bin Laden and his supporters in the Afghan Taliban regime. However, the Guardian newspaper of London revealed in a September 21st article that bin Laden and the Taliban received threats of possible American military strikes against them 2 months before the assaults on New York and Washington. Threats of war unless the Taliban surrendered bin Laden were passed on to the regime in Afghanistan by the Pakistani government, senior diplomatic sources revealed to The Guardian. The warning to the Taliban originated at a four-day meeting of senior Americans, Russians, Iranians, and Pakistanis at a hotel in Berlin in mid-July. The conference was the third in a series dubbed Brainstorming on Afghanistan and was part of a classic diplomatic device known as Track 2. Niaz Naik was a former foreign minister of Pakistan who was at the meeting. He said that the Americans indicated that in the case the Taliban, quote, does not behave, and in case the Pakistanis do not help influence the Taliban, then the United States would be left with no option but to take an overt action against Afghanistan. Naik said he told the Pakistani government, who informed the Taliban via their foreign office. The three Americans at the Berlin meeting were Tom Simmons, a former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, Carl Rick Inderfirth, a former Assistant Secretary of State for South Asian Affairs, and Lee Coldren, who headed the Office of Pakistan, Afghan, and Bangladesh Affairs in the State Department until 1997. Other news sources have reported that most of the identified participants in the hijacked bombings were Saudi Arabian nationals, many with connections to factions of the Saudi government. Yet it is not the Saudis that are being bombed. Why the interest in Afghanistan? The following article, published in the Asia Times on October 6, lays it out starkly. It's titled, Global Economy, the Oil Behind Bush and Sons Campaigns, by Ranjit Devraj. Dateline, New Delhi. Just as the Gulf War in 1991 was all about oil, the new conflict in South and Central Asia is no less about access to the region's abundant petroleum resources, according to Indian analysts. U.S. influence and military presence in Afghanistan and the Central Asian states, not unlike that over the oil-rich Gulf states, would be a major strategic gain, said V.R. Raghavan, a strategic analyst and former general in the Indian Army. Raghavan believes that the prospect of a Western military presence in a region extending from Turkey to Tajikistan could not have escaped strategists who are now readying a military campaign aimed at changing the political order in Afghanistan, accused by the United States of harboring Osama bin Laden. Where the great game in Afghanistan was once about Tsars and Commissars seeking access to the warm water ports of the Persian Gulf, today it is about laying oil and gas pipelines to the untapped petroleum reserves of Central Asia. According to testimony before the U.S. House of Representatives in March 1999 by the conservative think tank Heritage Foundation, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan together have 15 billion barrels of proven oil reserves. The same countries also have proven gas deposits totaling not less than 9 trillion cubic meters. Another study by the Institute for Afghan Studies placed the total worth of oil and gas reserves in the Central Asian republics at around $3 trillion U.S. dollars at last year's prices. Not only can Afghanistan play a role in hosting pipelines connecting Central Asia to international markets, but the country itself has significant oil and gas deposits. During the Soviets' decade-long occupation of Afghanistan, Moscow estimated Afghanistan's proven and probable natural gas reserves at around 5 trillion cubic feet, and production reached 275 million cubic feet per day in the mid-1970s. But sabotage by anti-Soviet Mujahideen fighters and by rival groups in the civil war that followed the Soviet withdrawal in 1998 virtually closed down gas production and ended deals for the supply of gas to several European countries. Natural gas production and distribution under Afghanistan's Taliban rulers is the responsibility of the Afghan Gas Enterprise, which, in 1999, began repair of a pipeline to Mazar-e-Sharif city. Afghanistan's proven and probable oil and condensate reserves were placed at 95 million barrels by the Soviets. So far, attempts to exploit Afghanistan's petroleum reserves or take advantage of its unique geographical location as a crossroads to markets in Europe and South Asia have been thwarted by the continuing civil strife. In 1998, the California-based Unocal, which held 46.5% stakes in Central Asia Gas, a consortium that planned an ambitious gas pipeline across Afghanistan, withdrew in frustration after several fruitless years. The pipeline was to stretch over 1,200 kilometers from Turkmenistan's Daulatabad fields to Multan in Pakistan, at an estimated cost of $1.9 billion. An additional $600 million would have brought the pipeline to energy-hungry India. Energy experts in India, such as R.K. Pachauri, who heads the Tata Energy Research Institute, have long been urging the country's planners to ensure access to petroleum products from the Central Asian republics, with which New Delhi has traditionally maintained good relations. Other partners in Centgas included the Saudi Arabian Delta Oil Company, the government of Turkmenistan, Indonesia Petroleum, the Japanese Itochu, Korean Hyundai, and Pakistan's Crescent Group. According to observers, one problem is the uncertainty over who the beneficiaries in Afghanistan would be: the opposition Northern Alliance, the Taliban, the Afghan people, or indeed whether any of these would benefit at all. But the immediate reason for UNICAL's withdrawal was undoubtedly the U.S. cruise missile attacks on Osama bin Laden's terrorism training camps in Afghanistan in August 1998, done in retaliation for the bombing of its embassies in Africa. UNICAL then stated that the project would have to wait until Afghanistan had achieved, quote, peace and stability necessary to obtain financing from international agencies and a government that is recognized by the United States and the United Nations, unquote. The, quote, coalition against terrorism that U.S. President George W. Bush is building now is the first opportunity that has any chance of making UNICAL's wish come true. If the coalition succeeds, Raghavan said, it has the potential of, quote, reconfiguring substantially the energy scenarios for the 21st century, close quote. And I was reading from The Global Economy, The Oil Behind Bush and Sons Campaigns by Ranjit Devraj, published on October 6th in the Asia Times Online. With more on the history of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Mordecai Breenberg of Red Eye Radio in Vancouver, Canada, spoke with Tariq Ali from London, England.
To examine this battleground, on the line from London, England, is longtime political analyst, novelist, and playwright Tariq Ali. His latest novel, The Stone Woman, will be out next month in paper, and it's the third in his Islam Quintet. Good evening, Tariq. And we had contacted you to learn more about the Pakistan, U.S. and Afghan sort of triangle. In the 1980s, the CIA sank billions of dollars in weapons, energy into Afghanistan as part of a strategy mapped out by Brzezinski of bleeding the Soviet Union into collapse. And Pakistan was a kind of important U.S. agent in that strategy. I'm wondering if you could give us a bit of an overview of that Pakistan-Afghanistan relation in the period of Soviet occupation of Afghanistan.
Well, even before the Soviet occupation, I mean, essentially what happened is that in 1976, the monarchy in Afghanistan was overthrown. One of the king's cousins, a person called Daoud, toppled the monarchy and declared Afghanistan a republic. And then he was very dependent on soldiers in the army and air force officers who were supporters of the PDPA, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, which was like a communist party, and they finally dumped him and took direct power themselves. Unfortunately, most of these people had no idea what to do with the country, so instead of at least having some referendum on the future, they ruled by fiat and bureaucratically. Lots of reforms were pushed through on education, large numbers of women were educated, lots of women were brought into helping run the state apparatus, the teach, be doctors, etc. And the United States at that point decided to destabilize this government, hoping it would draw the Soviet Union into a bear trap. And they armed the tribes using the Pakistani military intelligence services, began to destabilize Afghanistan, and finally they dragged the Soviet Union in. When the the Soviet Union intervened in Afghanistan, the American felt that this was where they wanted them, and they poured billions into creating a hardline religious opposition. And as part of this, at one stage, Pakistani inter-services intelligence felt that it would be good for morale if a prince from the Saudi royal family could come to lead the struggle. So a request was sent to Saudi Arabia, but no volunteers were forthcoming from the royal family. Instead, they recommended someone from a leading Saudi family, Osama bin Laden, who came, was backed by the Americans, trained, and actually personally very heroic. And he came and fought in Afghanistan and then stayed on.
After the defeat of the Soviets and their withdrawal, what was the conditions then within Afghanistan and its impact on Pakistan?
Well, there was a coalition of forces which helped defeat the Soviet Union, and after the Soviet Union withdrew, the obvious thing for any sane, rational power to do would have been to develop a coalition government, build civil society, give people a break. That, in fact, didn't happen. And the Saudis and the Pakistanis, who had built these religious boarding schools to train fanatics in Pakistan called madrasas, kids of Afghan refugees and Pakistani, poor Pakistani peasants, sort of deracinated, bleak cosmopolitanism, who'd been educated in these schools. There were 250,000 of them. All these schools were backed by the United States. They were hurled into battle. And because they were students, they were called the Taliban, which means students. And backed, helped by the Pakistani army, they took Afghanistan. And once they captured it, they wiped out all the opposition. Large numbers of educated women left the country. Laws they imposed were hardline laws, you know, sort of inspired by the Wahhabi faith in Saudi Arabia. Women weren't allowed to be sometimes not even seen in public unless they were veiled from head to foot. Television was banned, and it became an ultra, ultra-Orthodox religious regime denounced by the Muslim Orthodox Sunni faith in Al-Azhar in Egypt and by the Shiites in Iran and Qom as being sort of alien to the teachings of the Prophet. But the United States saw nothing wrong with this, and they hoped to use, lots of American think tanks hoped to use the Taliban to destabilize Central Asia. That's what's been going on. And till last year, $42 million was paid over to the Taliban to help in the struggle against drugs. The American oil giant Unoco is putting a pipeline through Afghanistan. So basically, they turned a blind eye to what the Taliban was up to till September the 11th. Now suddenly everything's changed.
And why that U-turn, and what are its consequences for both Pakistan and...
Well, the consequences of... I mean, the reason for the U-turn is obvious, that they think Osama bin Laden ordered this action. So far, there's no proof. We haven't seen it. He's denied it in an interview and said it was a glorious deed, but I didn't order it. Well, who knows? We certainly haven't seen any proof. I mean, the reality is, Mordecai, that the bulk of the people who carried out this attack were not illiterate, bearded fanatics from the mountain villages of Afghanistan. They were well-educated, highly skilled, middle-class professionals from Saudi Arabia and Egypt, where Osama bin Laden's cadres really work and exist. So they can't touch Saudi Arabia, the United States. They don't even like thinking about it because it's such a vital part of their security in that region, that the only people they can punish are this, you know, sort of deluded regime in Afghanistan, which is the poorest country in the world. Now, Osama bin Laden is certainly there, but, you know, it's the disproportionality of it, which is shocking. This was a terrorist act carried out by groups of individuals. Now, you don't punish a whole country for that. If you have the proof against bin Laden, then show it and extradite him, like with the Lockerbie bombers. But they haven't done that. They've decided to go, you know, it's sort of bloodlust and cowboy discourse rules the day, I'm afraid.
The head of the Pakistani military junta, Musharraf, has decided to go with the Americans. What kind of consequences does that raise for Pakistan itself? What kind of contradictions from these last 20 years are ignited by that decision?
Well, I mean, the fact is that for the last 20 years, the jihadis, the sort of holy warriors, have been working totally hand in glove with the American, with the Pakistani army, with the full knowledge and complicity of the United States. This is just a fact. many American think tanks working on this part of the world will tell you that. It's not a big secret now. They want the Pakistani army to collaborate in toppling a regime which the Pakistani army created. The only triumph and success of Pakistan since 1947 has been the victory in Kabul. So they want it unraveled. Who knows what's going to happen? I mean, within the Pakistan army itself, there is a hardline religious extremist faction. Its size is a matter of dispute, so we don't know what will happen. What the United States did was to threaten the Pakistani generals, either you collaborate or you're the enemy and we'll deal with you as well. Well, the generals were offered so much money that they've decided to collaborate. Pakistan's whole external debt of $38 billion will be written off. Just shows that these things can be done. More money will be poured in. Sanctions will be lifted if they play ball. So the generals are hoping that if they play ball, the country will recover. But in the meantime, the effects of this in society as a whole are unpredictable.
Pakistan was promised things earlier, and it seems not carried through by the U.S. What reason would there be for them to have considerable confidence in the current promises, whether it be the writing off the debt or anything else?
They will make sure that some of this will happen while these actions are going on. I think they have got some of these promises in writing, and the international financial institutions have confirmed this. Certainly the Pakistani finance minister, Shaukat Mahmood, is very excited at the moment. But the elite is certainly happy that they are back in the Western fold again after years of being outcasts. But the society in which they've created over the last 20 years is explosive. Lots of these jihadi groups are armed. They have their own training camps. They've been waging terrorist war against each other. They've been bombing the cities long before September the 11th, so I can't see them stopping now. And then the other thing which we've got to try and think about is, what is the United States going to do in Afghanistan? I mean, they'll bomb from on high and try and destroy everything first, but there's not all that much left to destroy because it's a destroyed country after three civil wars anyway. So they'll take American paratroopers will go in, and if they can find Osama bin Laden, capture him. But what if the Taliban fight back? I mean, there's too many imponderables in this at the moment, Mordecai, to be able to map out a scenario.
The former Pakistani Foreign Secretary, Niaz Naik, was interviewed on BBC this week, and he spoke that he'd met Americans in mid-July in Berlin in a conference on Afghanistan and was told by them that they planned to topple the Taliban before the middle of October. I'm wondering whether that kind of information sounds credible to you, and that the terror attack provides just an opportunity to proceed more effectively with a pre-existing U.S. strategy?
I don't know, because the Afghans didn't, you know, I mean, the terror attack would not be planned by the Taliban leadership. They're very provincial-minded people. What they would do is kill their rivals locally, which is what they did. Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was backed by the West recently, and had been fighting against the Taliban, two Algerian hardline fundamentalists pretending to be journalists went to see him and blew themselves up and him. He died after a short time. He was sort of quite a, you know, relatively secular-minded leader. So I think that information would have got them to wipe out their rivals internally, hoping that if they did that, there'd be no one to replace them. But the attack on the United States, I think, probably had been planned for a much, much longer time, because, you know, horrific though it was, the execution was pretty amazing.
Bush's speech on Thursday night, he seemed very much to raise the demands on the Taliban well beyond his initial order for the handing over of Osama bin Laden.
I think that the United States feel they have to topple the regime to show that they've scored a victory, and they might succeed in doing so, but what they don't realize is intervening in this fashion in the world of Islam creates more problems than it solves. I mean, the real hostility and anger is in Saudi Arabia and in Egypt, things which they don't like to discuss. And fundamentally, the two real problems in the Middle East are Palestine and the continuing sanctions and the non-stop 10-year bombing campaign against Iraq. This angers large numbers of people who feel that that double standards operate. Israel can do what it wants, Iraq can be punished, but meanwhile the United States only gets worked up if its own citizens' lives are put at risk.
Well, let me return to where I began, which was these talk of a 10-year war. We saw the U.S. construct a coalition in 1990 to destroy Iraq, and then they let that coalition implode because they weren't willing to address the essential injustices on the Palestinians. And then there was a coalition to smash Serbia, which left huge dislocations and ongoing civil war in Macedonia. It's murky, but I'm still wondering what you could penetrate in terms of America's new long-term, whether 10-year or whatever, war that it's...
The American ruling elite at the moment is split itself. Colin Powell doesn't talk of a war, he talks of a campaign. The others talk much more of war. But basically, this notion of declaring war against terrorism, I mean, it's a completely nebulous business. It's sort of grotesquely simplified. You can't declare war against individual terrorism because you don't know where the individuals are. I mean, Detroit is the largest Arab city outside the Arab world. I mean, in 10 years' time, if they go bombing the Arabs again, what if people there get worked up? Will they bomb Detroit? Are they ever going to bomb Saudi Arabia, their closest ally in the Middle East? Obviously not. But this is where the whole business hasn't been fully thought out. My own feeling is that they need a short, sharp campaign and a victory. And having toppled the Taliban, if they succeed in doing that, they will then come back and the rest of the thing will fizzle away, just like the campaign against drugs and the campaign against that and the campaign against other things.
Well, thank you very much. It's been illuminating hearing you. Thanks, Tariq.
Okay, Mordecai.
I've been speaking with Tariq Ali in London, England. He's a playwright and author. His latest novel, The Stone Woman, is going to be in paperback in October, and it's the third volume in a series called Islam Quintet.
What you going to do? Go and give the boy a gun. Now there ain't no place to run to, ain't no place to run. When he holds it in his hand, he feels mighty, he feels strong. Now there ain't no place to run to, ain't no place to run. One day he may come back, he pay us for what we done. Where you gonna run to? We're gonna run. But one fine day, all our problems will be solved. Bang, 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 we shoot him down. Give him drugs and give him there's no one else around. Bang, 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 we shoot him down. If he preys only on his neighbors, brothers, sisters, and friends, we'll consider it a favor. We'll consider justice done. But if he comes for you or me, and we can place a gun in his hand, bang, 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 we shoot him dead. What you going to do? Go and give the boy a gun. Now there ain't no place to run to. Ain't no place to run. Now we'll all be at his mercy. He decides to hunt us down. Cause there ain't no place to run to. Ain't no place to run. He wants the chances that you took from him. Oh, and nothing that you own. Then there'll be no place to run to. There'll be no place to run. And if he finds himself to be a reflection of us all, bang, 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 he'll shoot us down. For you can raise your eyes to read the writing on the wall. Bang, 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 it shoots you down. Before you can bridge the gulf between and embrace him in your arms, bang, 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 it shoots you down.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
Next, we're pleased to present part four of our ongoing series, The Wizards of Money, with Smithy. Tonight, Smithy will focus on the symbiotic relationship between financiers and armies in the maintenance and expansion of empires. Smithy's a consultant to the banking industry who has degrees in mathematics and economics. As a result of hearing Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! On her local community radio station, she began to take a hard look at the negative effects of the monetary system on democracy itself.